Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Editor at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. My special guest this episode is Dennis Mitchell, CEO and CIO at Starlight Capital. Dennis, welcome. It's great to have you on the show. I'm excited to get your take on markets and also in particular, your take on real estate, real assets, and fixed income as well.
Great. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
It's been quite a while, Dennis. I don't know if you remember, but we spoke when you were at Sentry. That was the last time you and I spoke, and which was terrific. It was a great interview, and then of course a lot of changes came in the business, and for you, yeah. You eventually ended up at Starlight.
Well, not just myself. Most of the Starlight Capital team is in fact people who have joined us from Sentry after it was acquired. So it's been a great opportunity to finish some unfinished business, if you will, in building out this business.
Absolutely. Dennis, before we get started, for those who aren't familiar with you, Dennis Mitchell joined Starlight Capital in March of 2018 as Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer. He has over 20 years of experience in the investment industry and previously held executive positions with Sprott Asset Management, serving as Senior Vice President and Senior Portfolio Manager, and at Sentry Investments, serving as the firm's Executive Vice President and Chief Investment Officer.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Dennis, it's been quite a testy start to 2024. In Q1, stocks ripped forward after the Fed's December presser. And after falling to around 3.8%, U.S. 10-year treasuries are back up to 4.5% this week, with some headline inflation rearing its ugly head again. And effectively, that has meant for bond investors and for the markets telegraphing, that's mean effectively giving back most of the 6 telegraphed rate cuts. To add to that backing up of yields, Fed governors took turns last week walking back some or all of those 3 rate cuts. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think it goes to show you that most portfolio managers and most market prognosticators have a hard time sort of predicting where rates will be, where inflation will be, where unemployment will be. And it comes to a head at times like this where you're at a transition point, if you will. So we've ended what has been a global synchronized rate hike cycle. Most central banks are sort of in that pregnant pause before they start a rate cut cycle. And the challenge has been that the market has really raced out ahead of a lot of these turning points. So we've priced in, you know, once we got comfortable with rate hikes, we priced in too many of them. Then when we got comfortable with a pause and an eventual rate cut cycle, we priced in too many of those. And as a result, we now sit here with a market that has got a very low level of certainty as to what is next.
Right.
And sorry, not what is next, but when that next happens. I think everybody is universally agreed that the next rate move is likely to be a cut. But there is a growing chorus of people out there worried that specifically in the US, with the resiliency we've seen in GDP growth, in the labor market, and with the stickiness of this last tranche of inflation, there is a growing chorus of people worried that the next move might in fact be a rate hike out of the Fed. Everywhere else on the planet, quite frankly, with the exception of Japan, you are seeing a firm and consistent narrative that rates are going to be cut and cut by a significant amount. I think in the Canadian market, the Bank of Canada has done a pretty good job of telegraphing that June will see the first cut of an extended rate cut cycle that will bring rates down between 200 and 300 basis points. You know, a neutral rate somewhere in the 2 to 3% range, if you will, maybe as high as 3.5. But it's really the ambiguity out of the largest and biggest market, the U.S. market, that has got equity markets fixed income markets as volatile as they have been for the last, call it, 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, it really speaks to that theme. You know, it's both positive and negative, but it speaks to that theme of American exceptionalism. And, you know, while if the rest of the world and Canada are, you know, set to cut rates in the near term, that means a rising dollar as well, potentially. And then that might actually throw a wrench in the works for importing inflation. for us.
Yeah, and so what I do think you'll see is you will see that the Fed is probably going to cut later, meaning their rate cut cycle will start after, say, the Bank of Canada's rate cut cycle. And they may not be forced to cut as aggressively as the Bank of Canada may have to cut. So you're correct to surmise that the U.S. dollar should continue to appreciate versus CAD, but other currencies as well. You saw that at the tail end of last year, you saw the reverse of that. You saw the Canadian dollar strengthen on the back of what was perceived to be simultaneous and synchronous rate cut cycles and sort of a simultaneous slowdown in economic activity. Since the start of the year, however, the Canadian dollar has given back over 3% of that rise, as we've now started to anticipate that the Bank of Canada is going to have to cut sooner and likely more aggressively than the Fed. Now, I don't necessarily think that will result in inflation. And the reason I think that is because the Canadian economy is quite weak. Okay, like the employment picture is pretty robust. But if you look at the savings rate and if you look at business investment, the savings rate for households has gone up significantly. It's north of 5%, closing on 6%. If households aren't spending, an economy like Canada, where 60 to 70% of GDP growth is domestic consumption, then that becomes difficult to see strong GDP growth. Similarly, you're going to see a wave of mortgage refinancings beginning this spring and extending into the fall of next year. That will put further downward pressure on household spending and income. So I don't necessarily think that a weaker Canadian dollar is going to import inflation, simply because I think Canadian households are going to have to curtail their consumption and their expenditures anyways. So not really the economic outlook you want. But I do think that there is probably an offset to the normal calculus of a weaker Canadian dollar means we import inflation.
Yeah, and I think everybody here in Canada, that is, would welcome lower rates. But it really is a different kettle of fish for us in Canada than it is for the U.S. consumer, given that, and it keeps coming up, but I think it's a point worth making, is the fact that American, mortgagees have 30-year mortgages, many of whom have refinanced at, 2% or thereabouts in the last, 2 years ago. Compare that to what we have in Canada, which is 1 to 5 year terms, with rates having, basically is going to mean mortgage payments at least doubling. It does definitely put a crimp in spending plans for consumers here.
Yeah, but I would take a step back and I would look at sort of the relative health of our financial systems. There is a lot of innovation. There is a lot of capital sourcing that takes place in the U.S. that simply doesn't happen in the Canadian market. But there are pluses and minuses to that. If you go back to, the early 1980s, when interest rates were almost 20%, when you're refinancing mortgages or getting mortgages in that type of environment, locking in for 30 years, probably a horrible
thing, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and so,
absolutely.
if you look at our respective mortgage markets from 1980 to call it 2021, as interest rates have come down, that's allowed Canadians to have more disposable household income as they've been able to mortgage at lower rates, refinance at lower rates, and all of that has gone into domestic consumption. Now, I hesitate to use...
That's very interesting, Dennis. That's very interesting, Dennis. I haven't heard... it's the first time I've heard that take on the reverse, the flipping of the story, which is that, all the benefits seems to be for American mortgagees right now, who have had the good fortune of refinancing it at, the lowest rates in history. But looking back to the 80s, that's a very interesting take.
And the other point that I would make is that has benefited Canadian households, but it's also benefited the Canadian economy. Because if you look at how our relative banking sectors absorbed the financial crisis, there were over 500 banks in the United States that failed during the financial crisis in 08, 09, and 2010. Whereas there were zero Canadian banks that failed. And you're still seeing the legacy of that sort of failure in capital tests, stress testing, the constraint of dividends, the constraint of executive pay. So there are long-lasting impacts from the differences in our banking systems, U.S. versus Canada. And I would hate to throw Canada under the bus, given that, what we're seeing right now is certainly an outlier scenario. where you've had the fastest pace of rate increases over a short period of time historically. And so the fact that the Canadian system hasn't absorbed that as well as the US system, I don't think is a knock against the Canadian banking system. I think it's just, you know, no system is perfect. And, you know, we finally found a scenario where the Canadian banking system maybe isn't as advantageous as the US banking system is.
Yeah, I mean, even with last year's failure at SVB and Credit Suisse and Signature Bank, I mean, just to name
First
a few.
First Republic.
First Republic. And most recently, you know, the near failure of NYCB. I mean, you can't help thinking that, you know, even with that BTFD facility that was put in place, that there's a huge amount of pressure at the U.S. regionals. At the U.S. regional banks to this day, because of that held to maturity position in U.S. treasuries, where, you know, rates are volatile and you know, we've had this walking back in the last month where the long, you know, long treasuries are back up to 4.5, 4.7. You know, so lots of uncertainty, right? I mean, lots of, you know, question marks, lots of, you know, like in your, you know, your point, when is it going to happen? When are we going to see the Fed cutting versus the rest of the world? That makes for interesting, very interesting times, interesting steps that investors should or could take at this point in terms of addressing that uncertainty. What are you optimistic about in particular?
Well, I'm optimistic about long-term trends that I see intact. And so our business, you know, I've said for a long time, we founded Starlight Capital in 2018. I think all businesses should be founded at the intersection of two circles, right? What are you good at? And what is the market underserved? And where those two circles overlap is where you should start businesses. And so when I look at Canadian investors, retail investors, you know, investment advisors, their clients, small family offices, even small institutions, most of them have a desire to allocate capital in the same manner that large pension plans do, right? They admire pension plans because of the sheer scale of assets, the sophistication of the model, the long-term focus. Well, if I look at Canadian pension plans, the 10 largest pension plans have, on average, 46% of their assets in private real estate, private infrastructure, and private equity. And right. If you look at the returns, you can see why they've made those strategic allocations. And so I think a lot of investors would like to replicate that, but they haven't had the access. And so I'm optimistic about those sectors simply because the average Canadian investor is probably 1 or 2% in those three major subgroups. And over time, we're going to see more and more capital flow from traditional listed equities, traditional sort of fixed income, and into these longer term private assets that allow investors to compound returns that are uncorrelated to the market, that still produce very tax efficient income, and will actually right. allow these investors to hit their long term investment goals. Now, there's a lot of education that needs to take place, and there's a lot of due diligence that has to be done, certainly. But I'm optimistic that investors, smaller investors and everyday Canadian investors are going to make that leap, and it will be to the benefit of their performance, their standard of living, and the returns they earn.
Yeah, I mean, we have the problem, you know, I recall the classic problem of, you know, home country bias, where, you know, you had Canada represents 3% of the world, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, but let's say it's around 3%. But you know, Canadian investors, of course, have the overwhelming majority of their assets, in domestic markets. And, you know, so it was hard enough, you know, it was challenging to make the case for why, I don't think it was hard to make the case to invest in the U.S. so much, but to go further, you know, farther afield into emerging markets, in some cases, global markets, Europe, was a challenging case in itself. Now, you know, since 2019, we've opened up the Canadian retail market to alternatives and real assets and, you know, in vehicles that were once only available to institutions and ultra high net worth investors or large individual investors. So it's interesting when you see, you know, that we now have the ability to do that. The problem, you know, I think one of the problems and part of the educational process is that, you know, individuals need to sort of warm up more to the idea of, you know, holding assets that at times they might not like and, you know, might not be performing as well as the Magnificent Seven. But, you know, the situation that always arises is that, you know, when the market does, you know, when traditional equity and bond markets are having a, you know, are challenged, you know, a correction in stocks, that's when investors, you know, sort of the light bulb goes off and, you know, why didn't we own some of these other assets? Why didn't we own more commodities, or why didn't we own more, you know, infrastructure or real estate or other real assets like gold or, you know, and that's the classic, you know, sort of line item problem, is that when advisors do their reviews, you know, the client's sitting there saying, you know, why do we own this? Why do we own this? Why do we own this? And then, you know, for those who have diversified properly, you know, diversification is supposedly the free lunch. But it's the most difficult free lunch, you know, for advisors and investors alike to retain in their portfolios, which is that, you know, when markets are doing, you know, when stocks are doing what they did the last quarter and the last, you know, in the bull market, investors, you know, are sort of loath to own diversifiers and uncorrelated asset categories. So, you know, it's interesting to see that, you know, that there's still a fairly long runway to get investors on board with these non-traditional assets, like private equity, like infrastructure, like private credit.
Well, I would say, Pierre, I'm old enough to remember the when there were caps on how much foreign equity you could have in your RRSP. I have analysts who work for me here. Who are in their 20s. Yeah, and analysts who work for me who are in their 20s who are shocked to realize that at one point you were capped at 20%, and it was a banner day when that cap was lifted to 30%. I'm old enough to remember that. And so I think part of the reason that Canadians haven't diversified more aggressively is access and choice and the ability to. So, you know, it's within the last 20 years, you were really capped at investing domestically in sort of your bigger pools of investment savings. And then when those caps were lifted, again, I'm old enough to remember when banks began, you know, distributing third-party mutual funds, right? And that was a huge innovation in the Canadian market. So I would say it's only very recently, in the last sort of 15 years, that Canadians have had the option and the access to a lot of these asset classes and the ability to invest meaningfully outside of Canada. And, you know, there have been some hiccups. Again, I'm old enough to remember some of the challenges around ABC Paper and Portis Asset Management, some other greatest misses in the Canadian financial services industry. And that tends to sour some investors. You know, bad news will circle the globe before good news has a chance to get out of bed, right?
Right.
And I know I've stolen that analogy from The Truth. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, investors remember the things that caused them to lose money and caused them pain more so than they remember the things that, you know, contributed to their returns. And there's a validity to that, right? I mean, you build an investment portfolio and you expect it to deliver returns. And so when it does, you know, it's kind of the sense of, well, that's what it's supposed to do. And when it doesn't deliver returns, or when something does appear to be a lag or a drag on performance, well, that's not what you were expecting. And you're very, very hypersensitive to why is that the case. And I think to your point, Pierre, a lot of education has to take place. Investors do have to understand that the number one benefit that advisors and asset managers like myself provide is diversification. If you've got just one asset class in your portfolio, it doesn't matter what that asset class is, at some point it's going to underperform. And you are going to want to have things in your portfolio that are going to pick up the slack when that one asset class underperforms. Could be fixed income, could be equities, could be private assets. But at some point, you're going to want to have some diversification in your portfolio to drive consistent long-term returns. And it is a challenge when, you know, you've got a diversified portfolio and there are one or two things that aren't carrying their weight, it is very tempting for, investors to say, well, let's get rid of that. My returns would be better if I got rid of that and bought some more of this thing that's working. And that, that's the path towards over-concentration and eventually, the potential for catastrophic returns if something like the financial crisis happens at a time where you're over-allocated to one asset class.
In that vein, what are you pessimistic about? And what are some mostly unforeseen or underestimated risks that you've been thinking about?
Right. Well, the thing I'm most pessimistic about actually is the risk coming out of sort of politics. So geopolitical risk. And I mean, right. We have some obvious examples with the Middle East, with Russia and the Ukraine. Those are certainly concerns that I have simply because they undermine political stability. And you really do need political stability for equity markets and global markets to function at their best. When politicians are forced to take one position over another in a definitive stance, like, the geopolitical conflicts that I mentioned force them right. to, it really does create situations where you may be forced down a path that isn't ideal long term. And so we're starting to see a lot of policy being created on the fly in North America in particular, that is skewed towards capturing votes as opposed to what's best long term for standards of living domestically. And so, and it opens the door for, right now, if I drill down, I'm most concerned with the rise of authoritarianism that we're seeing in a number of countries that are established democracies. And the reason I am really concerned about authoritarianism is because the erosion of democracy takes with it things like free markets and property rights and the ability for anyone within a country to rise up and contribute, and so we really have to understand that as long as we have the free flow of ideas and capital, next year will be better than last year. And 10 years from now, our standard of living will be better than it was 10 years ago. And we'll have this continued march forward. But the moment that we, the moment that we tip over into authoritarianism, where we stifle, the free flow of ideas and the free flow of capital, that's when we start to backtrack. That's when standards of living start to decline. And that's when we put sort of innovation and progress at risk. So that's the thing that I'm most concerned with, because quite honestly, Pierre, if you leave markets alone, money flows where it's best taken care of, right? And by taken care of, I mean respected, given transparency, and returns delivered in commensurate with the risk incurred. So left alone, capital markets will do a good job of raising our collective standard of living. But, it's that authoritarianism risk that I see seeping into markets globally. That's what has me the most concerned.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to, the way that Putin, for example, was greatly underestimated. I recall, going back to 2000, going back to the point where Putin was actually put into power after sort of, sneaking his way through the FSB and into the halls of power under Yeltsin, that, the moment he was, appointed or made, took the position of president, he started immediately to roll back the free market reforms that his predecessors had been, working so diligently to put in place. And he gave all the power, he gave increasing powers to some of his oligarchs and took some power away from others who protested. But the world sort of sat back and let it happen.
I'll say one thing about that, Pierre, is the concept of opportunity cost is easy to teach in a classroom, but it's really, really difficult to absorb and do something with in real time in markets. And so the reason I bring up opportunity cost is because world leaders could see the impact on the Russian economy, but what they didn't extrapolate out is, what does that mean for the rest of us? Russia is a country of tens of millions of people. There are some very intelligent, innovative, smart people in Russia who haven't had the ability to exercise their skills and benefit the global economy with their talent. I mean, imagine if Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos or Warren Buffett or, you know, take your pick. If any of them had been born in Russia instead of the United States, the world would have been deprived of their talents, their innovation, and eventually, and ultimately the companies they founded. All of us would have enjoyed a lower standard of living. So it's that concept of opportunity cost, right? How many fantastic Russian entrepreneurs have we been denied because of the rise of authoritarianism and the rollback of free market reforms that's taken place over the last, call it 30 years. So it's, but it's, again, it's difficult for a Western world leader to say, you know, the opportunity cost of allowing Putin to rise and depriving the global economy of the talents of Russian citizens outweighs the fact that, you know, Germany gets 40% of its energy from Russian oil and gas. You know, so it's hard to appreciate that opportunity cost, the ephemeral or the potential versus the right now.
Yeah, I mean, when you consider that Biden has been trying to dissuade Zelensky from attacking Russian refineries, you know, it makes you scratch your head, wonder, you know, are they more worried about the price of oil or the Ukraine?
You know? Well, I'll go you one better. I think most scholars of World War II have correctly said that, you know, Western Europe's appeasement of Hitler is allowed, emboldened him and amplified what became World War II. But yet here we are, you know, 70 years later, repeating similar mistakes.
The sanctions aren't working either, right? The sanctions have actually put more, an increasing amount of wealth into Russia's coffers.
Well, Russia understood that they were going to be sanctioned because they were sanctioned before. Yeah. And I think what people have to realize is that as much as you make plans, other people make plans too. So sanctioning Russia with a second round of sanctions after, you know, their foray into Crimea wasn't going to be as effective because, well, they had time to plan and prepare and think about what they would do if they were sanctioned again. And so even the pullout of major Western companies hasn't had the impact that I think the Western world thought it would have, because Russia, quite frankly, has had a chance to prepare and think about what they would do in light of that. And quite honestly, there are other authoritarian regimes that are happy to support Russia's initiatives and aims because they have similar aspirations, right? I mean, the most easy one to point to is China and Taiwan. So, you know, the reason
these three flashpoints
grow is because the lessons that we learned in the past aren't necessarily the solutions to the problems we'll face in the future.
You got these three flashpoints right now. I mean, there's Russia, Ukraine, there's China, Taiwan, which seems to be, you know, more under control than the other two. And you've got Iran and the Israel-Hamas conflict. And, you know, you have politicians like Lindsey Graham standing up and saying, you know, we'll blow you up. We'll blow up your refineries if you don't back off. You know, that kind of talk it's interesting. I mean, we had a great conversation with Doomberg about this idea, and, you know, politically, it sounds great over here in the West, but to Iran, it's a very serious threat. And, you know, the problem, of course, of bombing Iran, you know, oil production, is that too would have an undue impact, a geopolitical impact on not only the price of oil, but obviously the entire stability of the region. Your point about what you've been thinking about makes a great deal of sense, especially in such a flashpoint year with the upcoming U.S. election and you know, the tiptoeing around that's happening in order to maintain the U.S. economy until after the election, you know, in order to maintain the stability of the global economy until after the election. There's a lot of fancy footwork taking place right now, which is troubling.
Well, one thing I will say is that the world has become a much smaller place and a much more dangerous place as time has marched on. You know, if you're a student of history and you think of some of the great battles that have been fought, I remember the Battle of Hastings in 1066. Those were battles that were fought between hundreds and maybe thousands of people on either side. Today, you have standing armies in the hundreds of thousands and millions, and you have weapons of tremendous destructive power. And so as the world has gotten smaller because you can transport people across vast spaces and you can bring physical destruction and horrific acts over longer distances. So that's what I mean about the world getting smaller. And the other thing we have to keep in mind is that the threat of populism has always been there. You know, if you go back in time 400 or 500 years, societies were broken up into different classes. You know, nobody was going to become part of the aristocracy unless their family traced back to money for 3, 4, or 5 generations. And so it created a class of people who were stewards, if you will, who at least had the skills or the training to be in power and to make decisions. What populism does is it's a great democratizer, meaning anyone can rise to power. But it also means that you end up with a lot of people in power who don't necessarily have the training, skills, or even talent or even desire to actually make rules, pass legislation, and steward an economy. And I think that's part of the problem that you're seeing in the United States in particular, right, where you have an entire political party that is now beholden to a group of people who don't show any interest in actually governing or actually advancing legislation that would steward an economy. And that is a very dangerous place to be in, because no matter, you know, whether you subscribe to American exceptionalism or not, the fact of the matter is that somebody has to actually have their hand on the wheel. Somebody has to actually be shepherding the economy forward. Somebody has to actually be stewarding the populace. And when people who are supposed to be doing that abdicate their roles, it's not just chaos that ensues. Because the world has gotten so much smaller and dangerous, there are much greater threats that are longer lasting and much more detrimental to sort of our continued march forward as a species. So, you know, even dovetailing away from war, AI, you know, right, the idea that we would create technology that would at some point surpass us sounds far-fetched and, you know, the realm of Terminator, until you think about the fact that the evolution of the human species or any species on the planet is a function of one species leaping ahead of others and, you know, expressing their dominance. It shouldn't be that far-fetched that we would be the authors of our own demise if we're not careful with how we, you know, treat AI and how we develop that industry.
It's a lot topic, to think about, Dennis. Thoughts, yeah. It is very, 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 you know, there's a lot to be pessimistic about. I mean, there's a lot of potential for these and other, you know, outcomes to occur. Given the geopolitical climate, which is really, you know, in some cases a tinderbox, how would you describe the current investment climate? And given your thoughts, the things that you're thinking about, how, you know, how have you made any significant changes in your outlook, and have you made any significant changes as a result of some of your thoughts, some of your thinking, in the way you manage money and the portfolios?
I would say yes and no. From a strategic standpoint, the way we manage money doesn't change. We're always looking for great businesses, and, you know, great businesses have 4 attributes, right? They generate strong recurring free cash flow from a portfolio of irreplaceable assets that are capitalized by low debt, and they're run by management teams that behave like owners and treat their investors like partners. So that strategic element of how we allocate capital and how we consider risk, you know, risk is the potential for the permanent loss of purchasing power. Those things and those elements will never change. What the geopolitical climate, or quite frankly, the business cycle or the economic cycle do, is they change where we can find those opportunities and where we're offered enough return for the risk that we're exposed to. So, you know, if I look at our real estate portfolios, 2 years ago, if you were asking me where we're finding the best opportunities, I would have said that the portfolio is heavily skewed towards residential and industrial. Those are the two subsectors where we see the most sort of long-term returns. You can add cell towers and data centers to that. Today, what you'll see is that we've added a ton of retail and seniors housing to the portfolio. You know, and again, those are because we just came through a pandemic that absolutely gutted retail and seniors housing real estate. And so from a valuation standpoint, there were tremendous opportunities. What was missing was the operational piece. And now what we're seeing is, you know, on the seniors housing side, we're seeing a recovery in occupancy. We're seeing a recovery in rates. You know, the strong housing market in across North America is also a tailwind for seniors housing. So those elements create an opportunity for us to allocate capital to a different sector. But the way we sort of analyze those businesses within that sector hasn't changed. So the answer is yes and no. No, in that strategically will never change, but tactically, economics and geopolitical events give us an opportunity to move capital in different places, different companies, different sectors, different geographies.
What does that mean for portfolio construction in that context?
Right. So I think that for a long time, the 60-40 portfolio has been outdated. And again, I come back to large pension plans globally, not just in Canada, haven't been 60-40 for more than a decade. You know, David Swensen at Yale was sort of the pioneer of moving away from a 60-40 portfolio and embracing not just alternative assets, but illiquid assets. In fact, he looked at alternative assets and illiquid assets as having better long-term returns. And he looked at liquidity as a negative and said that the more liquidity you have in the portfolio, the more you have to absorb lower returns and underperformance. And I think you've seen some of that over the last several years. But I would say that, you know, if I'm looking at portfolios going forward, it's not just, you know, and maybe he's speaking his book a little bit, but if you look at sort of Bruce Flatt over at Brookfield, you know, that's a $900 billion asset manager, and most of their assets are in what you would call alternative asset classes. He sees private wealth and mass affluent investors eventually getting to a 20% allocation on their way to 60% to match where institutions are globally. If that's right, the case, then 60-40 has been dead and will not be resurrected anytime soon. And I think that just makes sense from the standpoint of, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to deliver efficient returns, right? And by efficient returns, I mean, for all the risk that you're taking, are you getting enough return potential to justify the risk that you're taking? And I think if someone approaches building a portfolio that way, it makes a lot of sense that you're going to have less in your listed equities portfolio, less in your traditional fixed income, and you're going to have more of these alternative asset classes like private real estate, private infrastructure, private equity. And those asset classes require a long-term patient investor to harvest long-term returns through actual value creation, as opposed to, you know, something has happened or rates haven't been cut or rates were cut more than you thought, right, and multiples expand or contract accordingly. Those are short-term returns, but longer-term returns are driven by actual value creation, actual cash flow growth, right? And so I think out of asset classes that are traditionally labeled alternative, that's where you're going to get the lion's share of those returns going forward. And so I think investors are, you know, 60-40 is old. I think investors have to embrace something closer to, you know, 40-30-30, you know, with the 40 being in alternatives and that being the bulk of their assets. And right, just a comment on liquidity.
Yeah.
I think the absence of liquidity is often looked at as a risk. But I would look at it and say the one investment that most households get right is their house, right? When people enter home ownership, it's right, usually the one investment that people don't get wrong. And, you know, if you look at sort of the negatives that people ascribe to alternative assets, they'll say, well, am I getting a yield, right? Is it liquid? How much am I going to have to pay to exit this asset? Am I going to have to take a discount? All of that applies to home ownership, right? I mean, if you own a home, it's relatively illiquid. If you want to sell it, you're going to pay commissions and you're going to incur, you know, land transfer tax and so on and so forth. And it's a negative cash flowing asset, right? As soon as you buy it, you're on the hook for not just the mortgage, but all of the upkeep and all of the operating costs. So by that rationale, the same people who are telling you that alternative assets are risky because they're illiquid, those would be the people who would also be counseling you away from home ownership for the same reasons. And I come back to illiquidity. Not everything in an investor's portfolio must be liquid, right? I mean, if you have an unexpected $2,000 repair bill for your car, you don't start by listing your house for sale, right? You start with your, you know, you start with your liquid savings. You might have to cash in a GIC. Maybe you have to pull money out of your TFSA. Maybe you have to pull money out of your RRSP, but nobody goes directly to, you know, I have an unexpected bill. I've got to sell my house and my car and to pay for this bill. And so similarly for investment portfolios, just because everything in your portfolio isn't T+2 illiquid doesn't necessarily mean that you've got a risky portfolio.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's an exceptional take, Dennis. I just wonder, you know, are we, you know, are the majority of investors just doing what they know and not investing the time that's required to get to know more about what you're talking about? Is it just that you know, we like the convenience of liquid assets, of being able to trade stocks and ETFs and bonds or bond funds whenever we like? We want the optionality of being able to liquefy assets if we need to, at the expense of getting into other asset categories that are less liquid or provide less liquidity options. It's interesting. I think the other problem that advisors might be having is explaining some of these. You know, that was very eloquent, by the way. I think that your explanation was eloquent. I hope that it provides a soundbite for advisors, you know, in terms of making the correct analogies and making the correct parallels to, you know, these challenging situations that they face with their end investors or clients. The problem sometimes is just being able to explain things to the end investor as an advisor, and in failing or fearing the failure of explaining it properly and having the investor say, I'm not comfortable with that. And you know, that's often that strikes me as, you know, sort of the most obvious reason why a lot of investors don't have, you know, Occam's razor, right? The simplest explanation is the one that works. You know, a lot of investors just don't like the unknown. You know, it took them long enough to get into mutual funds and to get into the market, you know, going back to the 80s and 90s, you know, for people to warm up to this. Now we have a much larger investor class out there. But how long, you know, what's that cycle and the willingness of advisors to not only understand it for themselves, but help their clients to understand it more fully?
Well, I think
because, investors are afraid of black boxes, right? They're afraid of things that they don't know about, and things that they know about, but they don't know anything. You know, like, what is this? I don't know. I know it exists, but I don't know anything about it. And I think it's that, you know, that unseated fear that keeps people from doing things that are right. And that, I think that's what made Swensen such a maverick, you know, at Yale, is that he complete, you know, he did a complete departure for, you know, university endowments.
Right. So I think first off, people generally aren't looking for solutions to things that are working. Right? Like the New England Patriots weren't looking for a solution to their problem of winning Super Bowls every year because they were winning Super Bowls every year.
Right.
They weren't looking for a solution to a problem. They were looking to perpetuate the Patriot way. And now that Tom Brady's gone and Bill Belichick is out, now they're looking for solutions, right? They got to find out how to get back, how to get their mojo back so that they can reestablish their dynasty. So that's the first point I'd make, is that people don't look for solutions to things that are working. And for a number of years, I would argue, even going back to not just the financial crisis, but going back to the early 80s and that recession and high inflation, equity markets had been working for people, such that they had compounded capital at a high rate of return, largely in an unbroken chain. And then you had a number of events that started to happen in more sort of rapid succession, right? You had the tech crash in the 90s, you had the financial crisis of the aughts, and now you've had the pandemic. And all of a sudden, right, investors haven't received the returns that they thought they were going to get. And so now you're looking for solutions. So I think the market is more receptive to innovative solutions in different asset classes because what they were doing before is no longer working. And then the solution, I think, you have to approach it from two angles. Yes, there's an education piece that has to take place, but how much easier would that education process be if people had the foundation of financial planning and investing to start with? You know, I have nothing against teaching students English and history and geography in school, but it doesn't matter if you're going to be a teacher, a nurse, a lawyer, doctor, plumber, or Uber driver for a living. You're going to need to have some sort of financial acumen. And so it's an absolute travesty of educational systems that there isn't some sort of financial planning education that takes place at the elementary level, let alone high school and then into university. How much easier would it be to teach somebody, you know, the rules of the Canadian Football League if they had started playing football in the US? How much easier would it be to teach somebody, you know, English lit if they already speak the English language, as opposed to having to teach somebody from, you know, Germany first how to speak English and then about our culture? So it stands to reason that if we had a base level of financial acumen in the general populace to begin with, the idea of teaching them about new and innovative investment solutions would be easier because they'd have the foundation to begin with. And then I think on the part of financial institutions, it is incumbent upon them to understand that, you know, while there are benefits of having a very top heavy, you know, concentrated financial system driven by, you know, five major national banks, it's incumbent upon those banks to understand that they are stewards of the Canadian economy and the innovation that we require out of that Canadian economy to advance our standard of living. And so it's incumbent upon them to have the wherewithal and the knowledge within the banks such that they can then be accurate stewards of these are the types of investment solutions that should be distributed and these are the types that should not be distributed. Because simply a rationale of we're going to eliminate all risky products and anything new by definition is risky, what that means is that not only are you eliminating the left tail of the normal distribution, right? You're eliminating a good chunk of the bad outcomes. You're also eliminating a big chunk of the good outcomes, right? New solutions that would allow people to have a more efficient investment portfolio. And when you're left with the middle, the problem becomes is that a lot of people, when they try to actively manage, overmanage. And so as a result, their returns get skewed to the left anyways. And then when you add in things like the pandemic, the financial crisis, the tech crash, you end up with more on the left-hand side of the return distribution and less on the right-hand side. So I take it back and I say, if we're going to try to eliminate left tail, we have to be cognizant of we're going to need to make up for that with more right tail because the normal skew is to the left. And so we can't just simply say we're only going to allow things down the fairway. We've got to open ourselves up to risk in order to be able to move forward and have more efficient investment portfolios.
Excellent. Excellent. Very well put. Dennis, what are, you know, you mentioned some of the portfolio building blocks of, you know, that pension funds have perpetuated. What are some of the portfolio building blocks that investors can think about, that advisors can think about to make their clients' portfolios more resilient? And what sleeves should they fund these from?
Well, so I think most investors would be shocked to know that, 20 years ago, there were probably about 7,000 publicly traded companies in the United States. And today it's less than 4,000. And I think a lot of investors would be shocked to know that 85% of the companies in North America that generate $100 million of revenue or more are private.
Right.
And so I think a lot of investors think that by investing in the S&P 500 or the TSX Composite, they're getting a diversified portfolio that reflects the U.S. or the Canadian economy. And that's just not the case. The facts just deny that. And so when you talk about basic building blocks, You have to start with, what is the Canadian economy or what is the US economy and how do I get exposure to that? And so, you know, listed securities are certainly a place where people should have capital allocated. Fixed income is certainly a place that people should have capital allocated. The problem is that the average investor has too much allocated to those two asset classes. So to your point, what are the other pillars of the Canadian or US or North America economy and how do I get exposure to them? And it should be clear from the numbers that I gave that private assets make up the lion's share of the North Right. American economy. And so by extension, that's why I said 40, 30, 30 with the 40 being alternatives, they should make up the lion's share of a client's portfolio. And you can argue that, well, if I own my own house, that's a big private asset. Absolutely. But then what else? Right? That gives you exposure to private real estate and one small sliver of private real estate. What other exposures to real estate should you have? Industrial, seniors housing, cell towers, data centers, and then moving into infrastructure. I mean, it's pretty tough to get through your day without drinking water or using electricity. So it stands to reason investors should have exposure to infrastructure, right? And there are so many subsectors of infrastructure that you'd want to get exposure to, right? Then we move into things like private credit, right? Most of the credit that's issued in the world today is actually private credit. Right. I mean, publicly traded companies certainly do issue a lot of debt, but again, most of the economy is private. And so if those private companies are issuing private debt, it stands to reason that is the lion's share of the fixed income market. And so I think those basic building blocks should be a function of what parts of the economy do you want to get exposure to? And I, you know, we can go on and on about commodities, but it comes down to how much of the economy are you getting exposure to and how do you want to get exposure to it? And how do those different components of the economy mesh together to create a diversified portfolio that will give you the returns you need at a level of risk you're comfortable absorbing?
Because they're private assets, you know, they're not getting the press. You know, I think the lion's share of the press about private assets has been about the mark-to-market issue, right? Which is that, oh, when, you know, markets were tanking in March of 2020, the private assets, you know, their NAVs were stable, right?
Right.
But, and, you know, so that spoke to the benefit of private assets, which is that, yeah, okay, as an investor, you're not subject to the volatility of daily pricing or minute-by-minute pricing. But there was a criticism about private assets that because they're not being marked to market, they're not reflecting their true, you know, the true value. So I think that's where, you know, that's a misinterpretation. That's a miscategorization of the assets. The reality that you're speaking of makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, what you're saying makes all the sense in the world. To me, it's kind of a no-brainer as far as I'm concerned. You know, when you think about it, like, where do most companies get their financing from? It's not from banks. It's from private investors, you know, other people with money, other individuals and companies that have money to lend that are looking for opportunity for their cash. Yeah. Where do startups, you know, technology startups get their investments from? Yeah, it's from venture capitalists, but it's also from private equity.
Yep.
Where, you know, I think When you're not participating, it's kind of like the same discussion we had about the home country bias. You know, why would you invest 50 or 60% of your assets in Canada when it only represents 3% of the world's opportunities? Why would you invest so much of your assets in only the publicly traded markets when, you know, there's 6 or 7 or 8 times more opportunity in the private market for similar kinds of businesses? And you're also getting the risk management from advisory teams that exist within private equity managers. Yeah. You know, these companies aren't lent money. And then it's kind of like Shark Tank, right? When you watch Shark Tank and you see, you know, the team on Shark Tank and you know, somebody, you know, Kevin O'Leary or Mark Cuban is going to be not only your investor, but is going to be part of your advisory group to help you run your business, connect you with people he knows, to help you to improve or grow or establish, connect you with people who can drive the growth in your business. So private equity is to me, that's a very exciting category because, you know, we have an entrepreneur class. We have, you know, in fact, the entrepreneurs in the, you know, in Canada and the US are also happen to be the wealthiest people in the country. And, and they have already. So if you're an advisor and you're talking to high net worth clients, often those high net worth clients are entrepreneurs who have had a buyout, who have sold their business or have, you know, move, you know, grown their wealth from their business and eventually will have a buyout or succeed it to their children or another investor. You know, so you already have a group of people who are, you know, if you're not talking about private equity to those clients, you're missing out on a huge opportunity to have a conversation that resonates.
Yeah.
And it's profitable.
Yeah. Well, one comment I did want to make was about private values versus public values. And I think of a lot of the assumption is that the public markets are correctly priced assets. And very rarely is that actually the case. I mean, if that were the case, then, you know, I'd be out of a job and so would most of the asset and wealth management. You know?
Right.
you know, and I, you know, the best example I can give you is the pandemic, right? There were a number of businesses that were legitimately negatively impacted, right? Restaurants shut down, gyms, movie theaters.
Absolutely.
They were legitimately negatively impacted. I would argue that a business like Microsoft was minimally impacted, right? I mean, whether you're logging in at home or in the office, you're still utilizing their software and you're still paying your subscription fee. And yet Microsoft went down just as much and in some instances more than the market in general. So the argument that, well, some private assets didn't see a markdown, you know, during the pandemic or as interest rates went up, you know, some assets weren't impaired and as a result didn't see a negative mark. Some assets were impaired and did see negative marks. And that's no different than owning publicly traded companies that benefit from an economic outcome or are impacted by an economic outcome. You know, there should have been more dispersion of returns between AMC and Microsoft than we saw during the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
And so similarly, the dispersion of returns you did see on the private side is more reflective of reality versus, you know, correlations going to one for all assets and traded markets and all going down 30-40% and then all roaring back at almost the same rate. I would argue that that demonstrates that the public markets are less efficient on a day-to-day basis than the private markets are.
Well, in fact, you know, more volatile, more risky because of the whims, just the whimsical nature of pricing, of stock pricing, of stock valuation. You know, I had a great conversation a few days ago, actually, and it was about Warren Buffett buying Burlington Northern Santa Fe back in early 2000s. And you know, the outcome of that conversation was that Buffett not only, you know, bought out the entire railroad, but was able to recoup his investment in that rail, you know, the entire acquisition cost of that railroad within several years. Because it was so profitable, but so undervalued and so underrecognized that, I mean, it wasn't a cigar butt as far as value investing goes, you know, but it was what he saw was that, you know, your company should be worth this much. I can buy it for this little, I can recoup my, I mean, like he's not the curmudgeon that most people perceive him to be. He's a shrewd operator. Correct. of you know, investing skill. What I think I really resonates for me in the private markets is the fundamental quality of the investing that's taking place quietly in those spaces versus the whimsical nature of public markets where you know, a stock's price is worth whatever the public market thinks it's worth. Whereas if you have an operator in private equity, the value of a business is worth what it's worth. It's worth what it's being capitalized for.
Worth the present value of its free cash flows.
Exactly. And so you can see the case that can be made where even private equity companies are taking over, are buying out publicly traded companies that are undervalued because investors have discarded them But, you know, there's a big difference between great companies and great stocks, right?
Yes.
And there's a failure often to make the distinction between the two, right? Just because NVIDIA, for example, is a great company, but is it a great stock at its current valuation? No, probably not.
Yeah, that's a tough one for me. I'd have to bring my colleague in.
It's hard.
We'll opine on that.
Right? Look at what happened to Cisco Systems, right? Cisco. Yeah,
or IBM.
Great company.
Decades.
Exactly. Like, great company, but was it a great stock to own if you paid, you know, so many hundreds times, you know, multiple at the top of the, you know, tech boom and in at the top of the dot-com boom? Yeah. You know, I think investors, you know, are, it's such a, you know, not only we talked about the geopolitical risks, but if you look at the Magnificent Seven or Six or Five or whatever it is now, you know, maybe we're back to the FANG stocks, right? If you look at the valuations of those, like anybody, I think if you're getting into the market because, you know, because of FOMO, because you don't want to miss out on that rally that's been happening. I mean, your margin of safety is awful.
Right.
For getting into that. What would you say, like, from these assets, private equity, private real estate, infrastructure, commodities, private credit, what kind of returns, what can investors expect from these assets in terms of their behavior, the structural correlation and return?
Well, I think it all comes back to growth, right? So if you're looking at GDP growth globally, you're looking at 6%, maybe 7% nominal GDP growth. And so that should tell you that the average sort of mature business should be able to compound at 6 to 7% consistently year in and year out. And then from there, you have to start risk adjusting, right? And so it's easy to risk adjust individual businesses simply just based on where are they in their life cycle and where are they from a size and scale and market dominance position. You know, I wear Nikes every day, and so, you know, I'm very cognizant of the fact that Nike has about a 90% market share in basketball shoes, right? And so, you know, when you start looking at sort of what returns can be generated in that market, that's a market that's growing at double digits, right? It's almost the perfect intersection of lifestyle and youth and culture. And so that's a market that's growing faster than, you know, the domestic economy as a whole. And from a risk standpoint, you can significantly lower your risk by signing up superstars and influencers to wear your apparel. And right. So probably the best example of that is Michael Jordan in the 80s. And, you know, he's been retired for almost 20 years and kids are still wearing those shoes. So when you start looking at sort of asset classes and where you can derive returns, it's a function of what is the baseline? And then is this an asset class that should deliver better returns, lower returns, and how much risk should be involved in that? But you always have to come back to what is the baseline for an economy, and if it's 6 to 7% globally, you know, if I'm investing in the U.S. with more innovation, should I get more than that? If I'm investing in sort of a country that doesn't embrace free market ideas and in the flow of capital, should I be getting less than that? You know, the subsector, technology and healthcare are two bastions of innovation, right? So should I be getting more return? And then always understanding how much risk comes with that additional return, what those risks are and what is the likelihood. You know, when you're underwriting credit, there are two factors. There's the likelihood of loss and the severity of loss, right? Those are concepts that should be ingrained within any analytical process, regardless of asset class. What is the likelihood of loss here and what is the severity of the loss if there is one? And, you know, for great businesses, the likelihood of loss is greatly reduced. And the severity of that loss is greatly reduced as well.
The key, if we're talking about private assets specifically, is that there's an incredible amount of management taking place within these private assets. It's not a black box. It's transparent. And, you know, I think that that's part of the misperception is that, you know, oh, it's private. You know, we can't peer into that. We can't look behind the curtain. That's just not true. I mean, in most right. private equity, most private asset management, you know, situations, the reporting is excellent. The management is excellent. The teams are managing, you know, these projects, these investments on a daily basis. It's not something that's just, you know, oh, we put money into this thing and then we'll wait 5 years or 10 years, you know, till we have a liquidity window or something happens, an event. Those are the misperceptions, right?
Yeah. The argument I would make is, to further your analogy, you know, the average person lifting the hood of their car, you know, okay, that's an engine. There's a cleaning part over there, and they're, oh, that's where the windshield washer fluid goes. Yeah. And that's the extent of their knowledge. And I firmly raise my hand and say I fall into that group. But for someone with knowledge and sort of information and training, when they lift the hood, they can see whether or not the engine's been maintained. They can see that there are challenges. They can see that this part needs to be replaced and why. You know, the sound that you're making is this part over here, right? So it comes down to your knowledge and, you know, how much do you actually understand the asset class and how much work have you done to understand the asset class? So to my point, and to your point, the reporting is sufficient. And where it isn't,
right,
if you have the knowledge and the expertise, you have the ability to ask those questions. So for a lot of, you know, and bringing it full circle back to Starlake Capital, one of the value adds that we provide is, you know, our knowledge and our expertise on private asset classes, such that if you don't have that knowledge yourself, but do want the exposure, you can allocate your capital to us and we can do that diligence on your behalf because we do have that expertise, we do have that knowledge, and where the disclosure is lacking, we have the ability to ask those questions and demand those answers.
Dennis, excellent conversation. That was a really enthralling conversation. I can't say enough for your eloquence. You made some terrific points. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity and I hope we speak again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. I'd love to have you back and get into more depth on some of the more individual areas that we touched on today.
Sure. That'd be great.